got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here, as always. Kevin, what's going on in your life? How are things?
Well, everything's just fine, you know, working through the semester during COVID, but enjoying the beautiful Florida winter and feeling really bad for those everywhere else.
Yeah, man. Even in California, it's kind of cold and rainy still, so I feel a little bit gypped, but I'm not in Texas, so there you go.
Yeah, they really got hit hard. And the worst part is when a place like Texas gets hit with that kind of cold, there's no infrastructure that's prepared for it. And, you know, heart goes out to them. So many broken pipes and, you know, things like that, that it's going to take a long time to come back.
Yeah, it's brutal. I saw people sleeping in their cars with the engines running, I think, just to stay warm. So
with the garage door shut.
Don't do that.
Please, that's bad.
Twitter people, we're not telling you to kiss hobos or run your car.
That's right. It's a little bit warmer. You get that extra layer of insulation, right? No. But not bad advice. Make sure that if you're going to sleep in the car, that you do it with an open garage door or with a tube connect to the gas, to the exhaust pipe out.
Well, while we're talking about things that are utterly false, I want to make just a quick correction. A couple weeks ago, we were discussing people tearing down statues of scientists and golden rice as a colonialism project. And I mentioned philosopher David Hume. We were talking about that, and I said he was alive in the 1800s, and in reality, he died in 1776. So I was just so worked up about the topic that I got the dates wrong.
That's the spirit.
Yeah. And it's been bugging me for weeks, and then we get on here to record, and I forget. So so there you go. Fallacy corrected.
Yeah, very good. And did you get like 100 emails that said you're an idiot, or not a lot of David Hume?
I did in my head, and I'm sure that someone at some point in history is going to listen to this and go, what kind of a moron doesn't know when David Hume died? So I had to, it's for my own vanity more than anything, but it is true now. So there you go. But with that, we can jump into our story. So first up, Terminator seeds, the anti-GMO boogeyman that never existed. Next, female, younger, better educated, and affluent. How alternative medicine has taken America by storm and endangered lives. And then finally, beer that combats cancer. Researchers are using gene editing to improve hops that might possibly treat cancer one day. But the question is still open if the EU, which is very anti-GMO, will actually accept the technology. But first up, Kevin, Terminator seeds. Hopefully this is gone for good.
Well, it's an unsinkable rubber ducky of the genetic engineering world, right? So this is a story by Mary Mangan. Dr. Mangan is a scientist, very well trained, and also very good in the analysis of BS. And she wrote this article for the GLP and really was an explanation of this reemerging specter that never seems to go away about genetically engineered seeds. And the idea the idea behind the Terminator seeds was, well, let me just tell you what they say it is. So you can go back to talks by Vandana Shiva over the last 20 years and many others who said this is a way for corporate America to kill all the plants and own all the technologies. And it's a biotechnology that will, you know, destroy everything. And they called it Terminator seeds and said that if this gene gets out, then all plants will be destroyed. And there's so many things that they brought up about Terminator seeds. that you have to use glyphosate to make them grow, or you have to, you know, there's so much just garbage out there on this. Of course, the idea that if a seed really did kill itself, you wouldn't make another generation, and no one seems to get that. The whole thing is born of an idea that was very much real. And this came from a number of people at the USDA and Delta Pine and Land. And the idea was, could you have a way to ensure that if you had a good innovation in seeds, that you could make those seeds not be able to be brown bagged, you know, grown at home and then propagated? We've talked about this with Percy Smizer and other folks before. And the idea was called Genetic Use Restriction Technology, or GURT. And it was, the idea was you could stop unauthorized reproduction of the seeds, but also stop gene flow. So the big issue of, okay, well, if this gets the pollen moves outside of the field and contaminates another field, criticism we hear all the time, that this wouldn't happen if we used this technology. And I actually interviewed one of the scientists who was on this team, a guy named Mel Oliver, way back in Talking Biotech 60s, you know, the 60, like maybe episode 62 or something. And it was phenomenal how interesting it was, because this technology never was really developed to the point where it's commercialized. It was done, but it never left the greenhouse. And most of that was because there was so much talk of suicide seeds and how it would, you know, the anti-GMO movement latched onto this and warped it into what it wasn't, that the companies that produced it, Delta Pine and Land, later bought by Monsanto, said, we will never deploy this technology. So it's the boogeyman that never was, yet still people demand that it exists. So there you go.
Now, what I wonder, and you can't get inside people's heads, but I wonder if folks like Vandana Shiva or Ronnie Cummins at the Organic Consumers Association, like, do they just not know what they're talking about? I mean, that's true in a lot of cases, but the cynical side of me wants to say they have to know better, but they think their cause is justified. And so if they have to tell you something that isn't true, then they're going to do that. You know, I can't prove that, but I just get that sense, because they're not stupid people. They're very thoughtful. I just don't know, like, how they perpetuate this with a clear conscience.
Oh, sure. And this is where you go to the, you know, the course question I always bring up, stupid or liar, you know, right? Like, what is their reason to spread misinformation? Do they not know, or is it intentional? And when you look at the intent, you know, behind someone like Vandana Shiva, she is intentionally misinforming you because she knows better. You know, no one's talking her and saying, there's these Terminator seeds. She knows exactly what she's doing. And the reason it has credibility and it resonates is because there is a thread of truth. Someone can go online and look up the GERT technology and see that Delta Pine and Land once developed gene control measure, a self-limiting, you know, measure that did exist and was something that they thought could be very helpful. And so when you have that seed of reality, it allows you to extrapolate it to big, horrible things that just don't make any sense. And that's exactly what she's done for 25 years now.
Mary made an excellent point, I thought, towards the end of her story. And she explains that when you scaremonger like this, you actually take attention and resources away from real problems. So, and Kevin, you know this better than anybody, but the farmer suicides in India, one of the big problems there was predatory lending. You had real pest problems. You had weather problems. And these were things that could have been addressed with proper investment in technology. And instead, everyone was obsessed with, you know, this GMO mustard that was going to destroy all living things that never actually existed. And I think that's really tragic that we're pulling our resources away from things we could fix.
Yeah, very true, especially in India, where farmers want this technology, both in things like cotton, in brinjal, and also in things like these mustards, which have been developed for India. And farmers are having a tough time over there right now. There actually is a big farmer strike, but most of them are smallholder farmers on a few acres of land, and they want technology to help them. And unfortunately, this is being used by folks like Shiva and others to work against the best interests of Indian farmers. But going back to, you know, here in the States, the Terminator seed boogeyman, as Mary aptly posts it, is something that they will pull out all the time as evidence of a malevolent source of multinational companies that are trying to control what you eat, control the seeds, control the economics, control the farmers, all of that tired narrative. It's just another technology that could have been used to actually do some pretty good things. And it's a shame it wasn't used.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it sort of ties into our next story, which is about a particular demographic that seems to be, I guess, more victimized by some of this alt health stuff. So what's this story about?
Yeah, I was a little hesitant on this story at first because I thought it would be just more bashing of complementary and alternative medicine, or, you know, which, you know, is too easy to do. But it really talks about, frames a couple of stories around a number of women who have stage 4 cancers, and how in the absence of, you know, with a terminal diagnosis and undergoing conventional therapy, also gravitated towards alternative therapies to take care of their problem. And, you know, the big thesis of this is that it is typically youngish, professional, affluent women who are the majority of the consumers of these types of technologies, particularly in a desperate health situation. And the author really started to ask the question why, and I neglected to mention the name of the author. It's S. Stiles. Originally came from an article published on a place called Quillette, and I don't have the original title here, but the title that in the GLP was "Female, Younger, Better Educated, and Affluent: How Alternative Medicine Has Taken America by Storm and Endangered Lives." And the reasons they really talk about why they do this is also mostly Midwestern or Western white women with bachelor's degrees, you know, this kind of a demographic. And why is that true? And the author really says that it starts because it's something they can control. When everything else has failed, nothing else is working, you know, wouldn't hurt, right? So it's something they can control to deal with this insurmountable problem. And that was at least the thesis of the first half of that article.
I want to, before we get into anything that might sound critical, I mean, I want to express some sympathy. I've mentioned on the show before that my younger brother had a really aggressive kind of eye cancer, and the only opportunity to save his life was just to remove his eye. And this was in the early 1990s. I remember even as a little boy, my parents being so helpless and so desperate that they would have done anything to save my brother, obviously. And I guess the only fortunate thing about that was that the alternative health movement wasn't really a cultural phenomenon at that point, and you couldn't just get on Google and say, you know, what kind of turmeric solution is going to treat my cancer, you know? So I could see my parents in the same circumstances today very possibly turning to some kind of therapy, or, you know, I use that word loosely, but you know what I'm saying, you know? I could see them turning to something like this because, as you just said, Kevin, you literally have a death sentence and you don't know how long you're going to live. So it's like, you know, well, why not a vitamin infusion or, you know, purified water or whatever. So at least at that point, I get the struggle that these people are facing.
Well, I totally do too. I had a friend of mine. She was, you know, in her early 40s when she had something called leiomyosarcoma. And it's a very rare, extremely aggressive cancer. And it's so rare that nobody really has treatments for it. You know, you don't get enough cases to be able to study it well. And she had this very, very, and she would try everything. She did all of the regular medical therapies. She got in every experimental trial that would take her. But at the same time, she was doing everything else, you know, any experimental alternative therapy too. And I said, you know, you kind of understand her mindset in that it's something she can control. And at the same time, we already know very well from the science that treatment effect is real, meaning it could be treatment with a placebo or something completely non-active, yet you still do have benefit as a patient. And that whether that comes from just the psychological benefit of having somebody care and administer a treatment to you, you know, then that's where you start getting in the foggy areas about, is it ethical to treat somebody with something that you know can't do anything? But apparently these things do have some sort of effect at that level. So you have to see the compassionate side says, okay, I understand how this can work.
I guess if anyone deserves criticism, I mean, obviously it's the people that we've talked about before that push some of this stuff, which is, you know, at best unproven and at worst can be harmful. And she goes into that a little bit. She talks about how once they start engaging in these alternative health practices, they start to eschew, you know, like radiation therapy and chemotherapy. And that oftentimes is what actually kills them, is because they just give up on the effective medicine. But I think the bigger problem, at least from my perspective, and the author cites two studies to this point, and she says that these people, they typically have some kind of a commitment to environmentalism or feminism or postmodernism. And not that, well, at least most of those aren't inherently bad, I don't think. But I think the problem is that like these ideologies are starting to infiltrate the culture, and they prize personal experience or some sort of a personal value over evidence. And the more that creeps into scientific and medical discussions, I think you're going to see more outcomes like this. And that's tragic. And so I think that's really worth pushing back on shows like this is, you know, you can protect the environment, you can respect women's rights without denying just like fundamental facts about cancer biology. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, totally. I mean, all of those areas have an element, and I agree with you. It's not like this isn't criticism of feminism and environmentalism. But it's saying that the folks who are very hardcore in their ideologies occasionally do have the sense of, well, I know in my heart it is this way. And that's kind of where you go to when you start seeing that, you know, folks who are really into Reiki, you know, this energy field manipulation stuff, or, you know, other alternative modalities of treatment. And then you have a $69 million industry that decided that it's going to take advantage of this. And so you end up with a very ripe place for abuse of people who are going to be paying for modalities that can't work and don't work and are very expensive, and someone else is profiting from them. And the worst part about this, and David Gorski writes about this all the time, is integrative medicine, which is now invading our medicine, you know, our rather esteemed medical industries, institutes, places like the Cleveland Clinic, others have received these massive grants and donations from different families that say, we will fund the development of a integrative medicine wing where you will practice acupuncture and herbal treatments and, you know, have, you know, meditation clinics and yoga clinics and deep breathing as part of therapeutic treatments, and they go for it. And under the idea of Wooden Hoyt, and it's $100 million.
Yeah, that's awful. I don't even know what to say to that. I mean, it's predictable, but I guess unacceptable. And I get how hard it is to raise money because we have to do it. But
yeah,
you know, and you do too, right? As a public researcher, you have to apply for grants and stuff. So it's hard to get money for what you want to do. But if someone puts strings attached like that and says, you need to dance in a circle on your nose or we won't give you this check, it's like, you know, I don't think I'm going to do that.
Well, that's where you have to do a certain calculus there, right? You know, they're giving you $100 million to build the new wing on the hospital that'll be there in 150 years, long after homeopathy is gone. And so maybe there is some sort of, you know, they fund the marathon and you play along with their sprint, and maybe that's the approach to that. It is hard to have someone offer you a whole lot of money to do something like that, and you know, and not be at least tempted to take it on, you know, in terms of, you know, as a medical institution, you know, is there a way of working this in a way that is reasonable? And I don't know exactly what they do. Gorski has talked about this a lot, and I tend to think that he thinks very negatively of these kinds of things. And you know, I can't say that I disagree.
Yeah. The final point I want to make and why I think it connects to the previous story we talked about is that like people come into an issue like cancer therapy with one of these ideologies we're talking about, and built into those is this idea that there's these big, bad power structures like big pharma or, you know, big hospital or whatever, you know, whoever the boogeyman is. And so people basically walk into this thinking, well, the people that have the drugs that could save my life are actually evil. And so I don't trust them. And so I think that's really the most harmful part of this. I mean, these individual cases are tragic for sure, but I think it's like these structural changes that are happening and how, as a culture, we think about medicine. That's the real problem as far as I can tell.
Well, let me throw in one more thing on this story. And I think this was the thesis that summed it up for the author at the end was, you know, many of the women who are involved in these therapies cite the ability to control some aspect of their own fate and their own treatment. But she says with that comes a burden, especially when it's something that doesn't work. And that when you're trying to cure yourself with a therapy that may be expensive, that's, you know, not doing anything, that maybe that's a little bit worse. And I think the idea of go with science, follow the science, turn it over to science, and know, you know, nature's going to take its course on these things. You fight it back as best you can, but do it with ways that are proven. And you know, so you can kind of see a thread between today's stories.
Amen. Well, on slightly more hopeful news, let's talk about beer that can get you drunk and maybe prevent cancer.
Yeah, interesting thought, isn't it? Well, this is a story. Well, hey, you know, it's worked for me so far.
I wonder though, does it offset the alcohol? Because alcohol is a carcinogen, right?
Right. And this is what's so unusual about this, right? And so this story is a great example of a headline that is writing checks it can't cash, and something that those of us who are in science, who fight back against misinformation, really have to look carefully at what an article says and what is the evidence that supports it. And this is, you know, very typical of a kind of article that comes out in a major media outlet that comes from a university press release that is very much extrapolated and misinterpreted and a little bit hyperbolic. So beer combats cancer. Czech scientists have developed gene-edited therapeutic hops, but EU biotech restrictions block rollout. This is by Raymond J. Johnson Jr. No, you can call him Ray. You can call him Jay. I didn't get that before. You can call him Ray J. You can call you. Do you know that reference?
No.
Oh, okay. So this was a guy on, look it up on YouTube. It was like a marketing campaign for Miller Lite, and this guy, Raymond J. Johnson Jr., it was a big thing in the 70s, and that was it. It was his only like little catchphrase, and everybody knew it. So anyway, so Raymond Johnson, talk about groups of scientists in Czechoslovakia or Czech Republic, sorry. They were talking about how there are compounds in hops that are present, which show some efficacy against cancer cells, and that could you use gene editing to increase their amounts? And they bring up xanthohumol, which is something found in the female flowers of hops. And, you know, the problem is that these compounds are present. They do show some efficacy against controlling the growth of cancer cells in a petri dish, but really don't have any demonstrated clinical effect. Yet, here's a group of scientists that are saying we're going to use gene editing to change metabolism in those organs to try to increase the level of xanthohumol that is found inside things like beer. And so with that comes this story that, by the way, beer is going to cure cancer. And so that is a great example of how basic research and some cells in a dish data get warped into a promise that it probably won't be able to keep.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of moving parts to make that work as a cancer therapy, or even just to study it, to be honest. But it seems like interesting science nonetheless, in the sense that maybe they could use it to improve the flavor of certain beers, or improve some other quality that might make it more pleasurable for people to drink. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I don't, like, all they did is they basically said, hey, we can use gene editing. Here's a new platform to edit hops. So that was the gist of it, right?
Yeah, and to their credit, you know, hops are a tricky critter to work with. And the idea of being able to do genetic engineering in anything starts with tissue culture work that allows you to demonstrate you could regenerate the plant. So in other words, take a single cell or a small cluster of cells and be able to turn that into a whole new plant. Just like when you take a cutting, you can make a coleus plant grow roots. You can take some cells from a plant and get them to grow larger. A whole new plant eventually. And so they were able to crack that nut, which is no small feat. And so they started thinking of what targets would you put on first. Well, what about some of these things like xanthohumol? Well, yeah, that makes sense. You know, could you do something that would cause increases in xanthohumol? The downside, of course, being that when you look at all of the studies that have been done on this, and there have been quite a few, very strong effects in petri dishes. But when you look at how it is absorbed by the body, they've done a lot of bioavailability studies and things like rats, and they show that it's extremely low. Basically, it just gives you lots of xanthohumol in your poop. So it goes right through you, basically. There's not a lot of evidence that it's really even absorbed. So really cute idea that you can do the hard work, looking good, but maybe not the best target in the beginning, but maybe a nice way to get a little visibility for your research. So that may be what this is.
And maybe, again, maybe I'm being a little cynical here, but I feel like some pharmaceutical company would have put this in a drug if it was effective as a cancer therapy. You know, somebody, and like not through gene editing, obviously, but they would have used this because it works, right? So the fact that it hasn't been used yet, and maybe this is a faulty assumption on my part, but the fact that they haven't used it yet suggests to me that maybe it's not particularly effective, or only marginally so.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the other parallel compounds like vinblastine or vincristine, things like that from periwinkle, or Taxol, you know, what you get from an unusual yew tree, all of these compounds are rare, unusual compounds that have biological activity that's legitimate against kinds of cancers. So good that they're examining the pharmacopoeia and identifying compounds that may have some sort of effects. Sometimes some of these compounds are present in such small amounts and are very difficult to synthesize or purify. So there's a good reason why you'd want to try to do this, maybe, because if you can enrich those flowers, maybe it could give you enough where you could do some legitimate clinical work, or maybe some animal studies. But right now, it's still seems to be something that is, you know, good on them for figuring out how to do the transformation of and regeneration of hops, but still seems like a long way before we're getting therapies from drinking beer, at least not beyond psychological therapy of drinking beer.
Right. Right. So have the occasional drink if you want that warm feeling in your belly, and then if you get cancer, take the therapies that your doctor suggests you take.
That's right. And that it's, you know, and stay away from the coffee enema.
Yeah. I don't, you know, again, people sometimes are in desperate straits, and maybe that makes sense to them. But I, from my vantage point, I'm just saying, why would doing that?
Yeah, the worst barista job ever.
All right. Well, that's three things we know aren't true: coffee enemas, David Hume in the 1800s, and kissing hobos, and there sitting you in your garage with the car running.
No, yeah, we're developing a litany of things not to do on a very scientific podcast.
We're on fire. All right, who are you following on Twitter, Kevin?
Well, because he came up in the article today, I would follow David Gorski. So he is at Gorskon, Gorskon. He's a I think he's the head of surgery, of breast cancer surgery. I can't remember the hospital now, but he's a hospital in Detroit in Wayne County area.
Wayne State, right? Is that where he's at?
Maybe Wayne State. Yeah. I get this all confused, but bottom line is that he's a, He is an expert's expert, and he's a very well published. He continues to publish. He is an expert in surgery and surgical stuff himself, but he's also an outstanding writer, a prolific writer, and covers pseudoscientific aspects of medical science all the time. So you can follow him on Science Based Medicine as well as on Twitter, and as well as his own blog, which the name just escaped me. I want to say Respectful Insolence, but
it's
got kind of an odd name and I never can remember anyway, but follow him in those places. Really a good follow. Who do you got?
I've got, since we did a Quillette article, I'm going to recommend people follow the managing editor over there. His name's Colin Wright. He's an evolutionary biologist and, writes a lot about sex and gender and some of these more controversial issues. And he takes a lot of heat for some of the things he writes, but he writes it anyway. So I think that's good. It takes a little bit of courage. And this is a science podcast, so we should challenge our assumptions a little bit. So he is at Swipe Right, and it's Right with a W, and Swipe is just SWIPE at Swipe Right. So follow Colin Wright. And I think that's going to do it for us this week. Thank you guys, as always. And follow us too, at Cam J English, at Kevin Folta, geneticliteracyproject.org. And if you guys could, if you're listening to this and liking it, retweet the podcast when it comes out, share it with your Facebook friends, just bring it up in conversation with your neighbor, because we love new listeners. And thank you guys so much. We will see you next week.